Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we've heard reports about people being arrested by immigration agents. This hour, we'll visit with a man who spent decades in the Chicago area and now is trying to rebuild his life after being sent back to Mexico. We'll get a lesson about security at polling places. The primary election is next week. Also, in 2024, a former deputy shot and killed a woman in her Springfield area home. He was found guilty of second-degree murder. It was determined Sonia Massey was experiencing a mental health crisis. That case has now resulted in a ballot measure before voters. There's help available for those in the ag community and their families who need mental health assistance, and a new exhibit focuses on the Gateway Arch in St. Louis, which is celebrating its 60th anniversary. Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Trump administration deported hundreds of people from the Chicago area last year. We've heard a lot about their arrests, but rarely about how they're trying to rebuild their lives following the trauma of being sent back. One of them is a Southwest Side man who lived in the Chicago area for decades. He was removed after being labeled a gang member. Like most people arrested, he did not have a criminal record despite the claims by the government. Adriana Cardona McGeegan first met him when she traveled to Mexico in December. She's been following his story.
Francisco Gonzalez Jasso is known by all his friends and neighbors in Chicago's little village as Panchito. After living in Chicago for more than 30 years, he's back in his hometown, Torreón, an industrial and mostly working-class city in northern Mexico. Panchito was deported 4 months ago, but the memory of his arrest when Border Patrol agents grabbed him on 26th Street in front of his friends and neighbors still haunts him. The saddest thing, and it hurts, is that they grabbed me, they forced me down, pointed a gun at me in front of people, children. Your world collapses. Your life is over. Tied up, handcuffed, in pain, disappointed. What did I do? He says. It's also a tough one to take for his friends at a taqueria that Panchito frequented. They remember him as a kind soul. They say he was like your daily cup of coffee, always there in the mornings before heading to work. But that sort of praise didn't travel home with him. Instead, shocking news about his arrest got there first, that Panchito was arrested and deported because he was a gang member. The Department of Homeland Security said publicly that he belonged to the Latin Kings, and the news spread like wildfire on social media. My family in Mexico had already seen the videos of my arrest, he says. He shows me a clip of when he is getting handcuffed. Panchito says he lived in Chicago without legal immigration status after being deported once before in the 1980s. But the government allegations about his gang affiliations aren't true, he says. He mostly worked in construction and in places that required background checks, including school buildings. None of that mattered. He was deported, and he arrived in Mexico in bad shape. He hadn't slept, showered, or changed his clothes in days. He had been sent to detention centers in 4 different states before getting to Mexico. He was in pain from the punches he got when he was arrested. And after 30 years, he'd forgotten his way around Mexico. On the bus to his hometown, he kept asking other passengers, is Torreón here? He then took a taxi to his block. He needed to check the number on every door. He forgot what his house looked like.
Y vengo ahí con el taxi, dele que di 2:10, 2:15, 2:45, vio la casa muy chiquita.
When he located the address, he says the house looked different, extremely small. He began screaming his younger brother's name.
César! César!
Once César came out, he felt relieved and told the taxi driver to leave. I was destroyed, he says.
Digo, ya vaya, ya venía destrozado.
The last time the two brothers were together, Cesar was 17. Now he's 50. He had lost both parents and two brothers. His home wasn't the same. On the day he was arrested, Panchito says the agents didn't show him a warrant and had no reason to stop him. When they said I was a gang member, I told the agent, no, that's not on my record, he says. Public records back him up. His name isn't listed for gang or criminal activity in the Chicago Gang Book or other city, county, and state records. I asked DHS multiple times to show proof that Panchito was a member of the Latin Kings gang, but the department never answered.
Si supieran que era un criminal, ya me hubieran agarrado después de 30 años.
I would have been caught already after 30 years, Panchito says. Advocates say Panchito wasn't the only one labeled a criminal. DHS has made other accusations and even filed charges against people, only to drop them later due to lack of evidence. After his arrest, Panchito was taken to the Immigration Processing Center in suburban Broadview. He spent about 3 days there before his deportation.
Mira, era un trato. Creo que los animales los tratan mejor que uno.
He says at Broadview, officials treated animals better than us. He couldn't sleep. He says his cell was crowded. He didn't get his medicine. He didn't get enough food or water. Panchito agreed to be deported, fearing that he would be in detention for weeks.
Yo firmé porque ya me iban a dar 6-7 semanas en la cárcel.
Back at his childhood home, everything looked different for Panchito. He was a stranger in his own home, despite his brother's efforts to make him feel welcome. Panchito jokes, I'm the intruder. And he kept thinking, what am I going to do, he says. I was deported like the worst criminal. My reputation is gone.
Es una humillación para mí por mi récord.
And he misses his little village friends and neighbors. They weren't his relatives, but to him, they were his family here. A few months after I visited him, Panchito is still remaking his life. He has a modest pension from his construction work. He shipped his clothes from Chicago and gave away the furniture he left behind. He's remodeling his parents' home, the kitchen, the bedrooms, the bathrooms. He worries about the violence in Mexico. One of Panchito's brothers disappeared years ago. He was never found. Panchito's other brother, Cesar, is always checking in on him. He wants to clear his name, but he doesn't know where to start. I asked him if he would want to return to Chicago, and he says yes, without hesitation. He gets emotional.
Y tan fuerte que he sido en mi vida, ahorita estoy explotando. A lo mejor me hace bien eso. Hay mucha gente que me quiere allá y yo lo extraño.
I've been so strong all my life, he says. But maybe letting my emotions out is good for me. There are many people who love me in Chicago, and I miss them.
Adriana Cardona-McGeegan with that report. The intensity of immigration enforcement efforts has grown under President Donald Trump's second term, and it's not just in Illinois. One researcher is trying to make sense of the actions. From St. Louis, Brian Munoz spoke with Syracuse University's Austin Coker and asked him to explain how immigration enforcement goes beyond the national headlines.
I think some of the most aggressive immigration enforcement projects in the country in places like Los Angeles, Chicago, Minneapolis, they're really designed to create headlines. They're designed to draw attention. And in some ways, they overshadow and mask the massive amount of immigration enforcement activity across the country in places like the Midwest and in places like St. Louis, where there actually is a lot of immigration enforcement unfolding really rapidly over the last, 12, 13 months of the Trump administration. And so I just think it's really important that even though we need to follow what's happening on the national scale, we also just need to look locally, because it's not only what can we understand about immigration enforcement, it's also what can we do and where can we act. And most of us can't act nationally. We can really only act locally. So understanding what's happening in our local context is in some ways more important than trying to follow every single big headline in the news.
There's a growing number of local municipalities here in Missouri that are signing agreements with ICE called 287G agreements or contracts. Can you explain what those are and what does that mean practically?
Basically, that means that when the sheriff's office or state highway patrol, like it's here in Missouri, or any one of the other, you know, nearly 40 jurisdictions in Missouri sign on to 287G, it means that they are taking on the role in some part of the federal immigration enforcement agencies. It can look a couple different ways. The most concerning and aggressive one, however, and the one that is now dominant across the country, as well as here in Missouri, is the task force model. The reason the task force model is so concerning to many of us is, given the fact that oversight and accountability mechanisms have been all but abolished within the agency to begin with, this most aggressive model of 287G means that if law enforcement officers are out there, there's no guarantee that that state highway patrol officer, sheriff, or cop can do any better of a job than the ICE officer is. And typically those officers will receive much less training even than the ICE officers. And so the concern is, and the evidence is that this can exacerbate community concerns around racial profiling, can lead to unlawful arrests, and for these agencies can generate backlash of lawsuits that can and have cost taxpayers in these jurisdictions a lot of money.
So some people who have been detained in these rural Missouri jails that have the 287G agreements have told me, and immigration advocates have reemphasized, is that they don't feel like the jails were ready for the influx of people that they've experienced in this last year and some change. And that's led to alleged challenges in the conditions there around medical treatment or nutrition or things of that nature. Do you think jails are ready for this moment, or do you think people really didn't expect the level of detention that we're seeing now?
So one of the things we've seen from the start of the Trump administration is the national detained population has gone from less than 40,000 people, which was already really large, to over 70,000 people in just 12 months. We've never seen immigrant detention grow this quickly. We've never seen this many new detention facilities come online across the country. We've never seen this many county jails roped into holding people for the federal government. So I think across the entire country, the immigrant detention infrastructure has ballooned in a way that was very hard to imagine as recently as a year ago. And we've definitely seen the infrastructure struggle to maintain adequate level of care for people in detention.
That's immigration researcher Austin Coker. He spoke with St. Louis Public Radio's Brian Munoz. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker has been withholding about 2% of state funding for public universities, and that's put them in a difficult position as they try to adjust to reduced state funding. As Abasola Dahunzi reports, lawmakers are debating a new formula that could change how Illinois funds its flagship and regional universities.
Financial challenges at Eastern Illinois University have led to a nearly $2 million deficit. That's led to department mergers and faculty not having their contracts renewed. EIU's student government president Claire Weber says the funding gap is already affecting the student experience.
I think a lot of our student body is quite frustrated at the adequacy gap. So most of the effects that I've seen from these layoffs and hiring freezes on students has been losing faculty that they really care about.
Western Illinois University is also dealing with less support. Zach Mastersmith, the school's director of governmental relations, says the university wants a new adequacy funding formula that's being considered in the General Assembly.
No university will receive less funding than they do today. I think that's really important.
The bill would calculate how much money each university needs based on formulas like how many students they enroll. While regional universities are backing the measure, the University of Illinois system is against it. Chief Financial Officer Paul Ellinger says the formula changes would hurt the system's interests.
The specific formula that is being proposed does not have good outcomes for the University of Illinois.
The Equitable University Funding Bill is being considered by lawmakers in the House Higher Education and Rules Committees. I'm Abasola Dahunsi.
Former Congressman Bobby Rush of Chicago is endorsing the congressional candidate Jesse Jackson Jr. with help from artificial intelligence. The digital and television spot titled I Have Something to Say utilizes AI to replicate Rush's voice as it sounded before his battle with throat cancer. The ad's producers say its disclosure of AI use and speaker permission set a new precedent for AI in political ads. Jackson's among 10 Democrats vying to replace the retiring Congresswoman Robin Kelly in the 2nd Congressional District. The Illinois Supreme Court is hearing a case about nonviolent felons having a firearm. Isabella Nieto brings us that story.
The case between the state of Illinois and James Benson stems from his altercation with his then-girlfriend. Afterwards, he was charged with domestic battery, reckless charge of a firearm, and unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon. During arguments before the state high court, his lawyer Elizabeth Cook argued restricting Benson's right to a firearm is unconstitutional because his only felony at the time was nonviolent.
Violating a law is not the same as being a dangerous person.
Benson is only appealing the unlawful possession charge, which was made due to his prior felony conviction carrying a firearm without a license. I'm Isabella Nieto.
Welcome to This Week in Illinois History. I'm Clint Cargow.
5 minutes have gone by in the period. Here's Bobby Hall, his pass to Makita. He's got Warham tearing in on the right side. Kenny Warham, a drop pass to Hall. He scores! Bobby Hall!
That's Chicago Blackhawks' Bobby Hull on March 12, 1966. He just scored his 50th goal of the season, tying the league record that he already shared with two others. The Blackhawks winger, known as the Golden Jet for his speed, skill, and dashing blonde hair, was one of the most popular players in the National Hockey League. His 50th goal came in front of a hometown crowd at Chicago Stadium. After a brief delay to clean off all the hats and popcorn and other items fans had tossed onto the ice, the game continued. And it took Hull only a few minutes to give the crowd what they wanted.
Now then, Bobby Hull from his own blue line. The Golden Jet driving at center in on the Ranger defense. Getting set, he may pass or shoot, he drives one. Score! And the crowd goes wild here in Chicago. Bobby Hull!
Hull received a 7-minute standing ovation. He ended the season with a record 54 goals and later broke his own record with 58 in the 1968-69 season.
If you saw that one, you saw hockey history in the making. You may never, ever see that again in your lifetime. Bobby Hull scoring 51 goals during a regular season.
I'm Clint Cargow, and that's This Week in Illinois History.
We'll be back with more of Statewide in a moment. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The murder of Sonia Massey by a Sangamon County deputy in 2024 sparked local efforts to examine policing and mental health resources. Massey was shot in her home after she called 911 to report a prowler. She was experiencing a mental health crisis. Now county voters are being asked to fund a special mental health board. Jordan Danielle brings us that story.
A referendum on this month's ballot would create a 0.5% sales tax increase to fund the board. That would bring in an estimated $15 million annually. Supporters say the dedicated funding stream would result in expanded services to help address gaps in crisis response, treatment, and community-based care. The push follows recommendations from two county commissions formed after the 2024 murder of Sonia Massey. She was shot by a Sangamon County deputy after calling 911 for help during a mental health episode. Senator Doris Turner of Springfield helped form the Massey Commission.
It has really been a wonderful opportunity for many voices, many diverse voices of this community to come together and say how we can move our community forward, how we can be better.
Creation of a special board is allowed under Illinois law and lets counties, through voter approval, levy a dedicated tax for mental health services. Turner says her work for the commission was deeply personal.
I moved in 1982, and when I moved on that block, there were 5 families of Masseys living on that block, and my neighbor to the immediate east still has the last name Massey. As a matter of fact, just a few days before Sonia was murdered, she was sitting on my front porch just talking as she would often do.
Members of the Sangamon County Mental Health Commission, which released its final report late last year, say the proposal reflects broader funding challenges in mental health care nationwide. Dr. Kerry Wolf served on the commission and chairs psychiatry at the Southern Illinois University School of Medicine.
Mental health is underfunded and funded separately from the rest of the healthcare delivery system, and that's a national problem.
The commission's report estimates Sangamon County likely has about 8,000 adults living with mental illnesses and nearly 3,000 with substance use disorders. While there is agreement on the need, supporters of a new board say the funding structure has been a key part of the debate. Jim Burge, manager of the Sangamon County Farmers Bureau, testified before the commission.
We would like to do anything that we can to help Springfield get such a focus, and that's where a lot of the need is, obviously, but the rural communities are not without need either.
Burge says a sales tax would spread the cost more broadly, including to visitors who come to Sangamon County for various events. The proposal has also sparked conversations about mental health within law enforcement. Springfield activist Sunshine Clemens says expanding services must include officers.
Because we don't want unhealed people coming out and trying to serve a community. So it's not just about law enforcement, it's not just about the community. Everyone needs holistic mental health services, so that's something I advocate for.
Sangamon County Sheriff Paula Crouch, who was appointed after Massey's murder, says attitudes inside law enforcement have changed over the past three decades.
Into an more of an acceptable, listen, everybody has problems and there's no shame to go talk about it.
She says the stigma has eased.
If you are suffering from a mental illness or you are struggling, you have to get help. You have to remove yourself from that situation. If Sean Grayson had something going on that night, and he knew he had something going on, he shouldn't have been at work that day.
Deputy David Tim, who is running for sheriff against Crouch, also supports expanding mental health resources and training.
When I started in my career, I could say probably 75 to 80% of the calls that I handled had to do with alcohol and drugs. And at the end of my career, after 25 years, 75 to 80% of the calls that I handled had to do with mental health.
He says agencies must be prepared as they move forward.
We need more training. No one's ever had the care and concern to talk to the county board and explain this stuff in real terms and use words, you know, like murder and rape, things that people don't want to hear. But that's the reality of what we do, and we have to be better trained to be able to deal with it.
If approved, county leaders would establish the board and appoint members who would begin agenda setting. I'm Jordan Danielle.
University of Illinois Extension is offering mental health resources for farmers and their families. Brady Johnson reports.
Amid tariffs, climate change, and economic uncertainty, Illinois farmers and their families can find mental health support from the state's land grant institution.
When we talk to farmers, we hear a lot about time pressures, waiting on the weather, hoping for weather, needing a certain type of weather, feeling as though they have a lot to get done in a relatively short amount of time. And then it's compounded by things like unavailability of labor. There's a lot happening in ag labor right now. There's a lot happening globally that's having impacts on the way farmers are able to purchase and plant their crop.
That's University of Illinois Associate Professor and Extension Specialist Josie Rudolfi. The uncertainty is causing tremendous stress and anxiety for farmers, said Rudolfi, and Illinois Extension is offering resources to help.
We know that farmers also experience unique barriers to accessing mental health care. And so with funding and support from USDA, we've been able to create a number of initiatives to implement across Illinois in hopes of increasing, again, access to various mental health resources and services.
One of these initiatives is offering three vouchers to farmers and their families at no cost to them to seek mental health care. These can be requested online and come with a directory with 80 providers across Illinois' 102 counties.
And so with that information, anybody who requests vouchers can then find a provider that's either maybe local to them or somebody who might have experiences that are similar to them. We then reimburse the providers such that there is no financial exchange between the client and the provider.
More information on the vouchers can be found on the Illinois Extension website, along with fact sheets on coping with stress and mental health literacy programs.
These are programs that train Extension specialists, clergy, Farm Bureau staff, others in the agricultural space to respond to an emerging mental health crisis, maybe by a family member, by a friend, by somebody in their community.
Illinois Extension is also part of the North Central Farm and Ranch Stress Assistance Center, one of four federally funded assistance networks. North Central covers 12 states from North Dakota to Kansas over to Iowa and including Michigan. Rudolphy said the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign directs this region, working with 19 partner organizations.
So we partner with extensions in all 12 states, as well as various nonprofits, a few healthcare organizations, and other specialty grower groups to, again, deliver the resources and services that they may not have access to.
Those needing care can text HOME to 741741 or call 1-800-273-TALK. Assistant Dean and Program Leader for Agriculture and Agribusiness at Illinois Extension, Travis Burke, said farmers can access financial planning assistance through its FarmDoc Fast Tools website.
Farmers have a lot of stress and things that they have to do, like budgets, and this time of year is very critical for coming up with operating capital, looking at their financials to see if they're actually going to be able to continue farming during the next year. There's a Farm Coach blog on there that provides articles on balance sheets and rent and farm lender and succession planning and that type thing.
You can learn more at extension.illinois.edu. I'm Brady Johnson, WVIK News.
In rural Knox County, where gravel roads cut through open prairie, writer and Knox College professor Sin Kitchen has been paying attention to seasons, to loss, and to faith. After years of writing and revising, Kitchen's new poetry collection, Broken Hallelujah, is coming into the world. Jane Carlson has more.
A raccoon croaked in the ditch down the road where, years ago, workers poured a concrete abutment to keep the farmer's field from washing towards the river.
Kitchen lives on what she calls a slab of land at the border of trees and prairie near Maquon.
Her plump body curled in repose, nose nestled in fur as if there was no reason to travel any further.
Through the large plate glass windows of her house, she's watched the changing of seasons and the cycles of life.
The tableau lives, or dies, at the bottom of a rise where I walk, dock, along the gravel way that he marks every few feet, covering a scent I cannot smell with another.
We've been listening to Kitchen read a portion of her poem, The Tableau.
Winter preserves the carcass, no aroma of decay, to summon coyotes, leaving the body unmolested behind its mausoleum wall. Doc and I will continue to pay respect until her body disappears, or for that matter, we do.
Kitchen has lived in this rural setting and has been looking out those windows and walking her dogs for 14 years. She says the poems in Broken Hallelujah began taking shape after she had been out there for a while, watching, listening, and trying to translate what she saw into language.
I started out kind of trying to capture things in photographs, and then one day it struck me, you know, you could probably try to capture these images in language as well.
Kitchen grew up in Galesburg, and she did not dream of becoming a writer. She did not become one until she was in her 30s.
Had lived a life where I was a young wife, raising a family, high school graduate, no real career aspirations, and difficulties in life created a kind of selfish urge in me to do something that was just for me. And so I took a creative writing class at Carl Sandburg College and never dreamed that it would lead somewhere else and that it would spark what it did.
Kitchen says that class unlocked the writer in her and let her off the leash. She continued her education at Knox College, earning degrees in English and creative writing, then got an MFA at Spalding University. She began teaching at Knox and published a short story collection. But poetry, she says, was her first genre and the one she eventually returned to after what she calls a 16-year detour. The poems in Broken Hallelujah are rooted in prairie life, but they are also shaped by grief and the changing seasons of Kitchen's life, from her mother's death to entering her own era of becoming a grandmother.
I never really thought of winter as a beautiful time. Everything's dead. There's nothing beautiful about winter, right? But when I got in close proximity to it, I began to see things a little bit differently. And I, you know, at the same time was seeing my mother in the winter of her life, and being able to just pay reverence to that seemed to make good sense to me.
The collection moves through solitude, memory, and loss, while remaining attentive to what Kitchen calls small, luminous moments. She says the title reflects that tension, praise that is imperfect and sometimes hesitant, but still offered.
I think about the whole collection as being kind of this prayer in some way, but it's flawed, like everything else, like everything in nature, like what lives and then what has to die.
While many of the poems in Broken Hallelujah were previously published, Kitchen says getting the collection into the world took persistence. She began submitting the manuscript in 2017 and racked up 90 rejections, followed by multiple revisions, before the book was accepted by Finishing Line Press. She says she tells her students that rejection is part of the work.
Over time, the one thing that I have figured out that separates people who get published from people who don't get published is that people who get published never give up.
Pre-orders of Broken Hallelujah are available on Kitchen's website or the publisher's website, with the book officially published this summer. And the creative writing professor, who never dreamed of becoming a writer, says poetry should have a wide audience. Kitchen says poetry is about saying really important things in really beautiful ways. I'm Jane Carlson.
A recently opened exhibit in downtown St. Louis showcases logos and symbols featuring the arch. It's part of the monument's 60th anniversary. Abby Larico reports on how its two legs and 630 feet have come to stand for an entire region.
What would a monument to expansion look like? Nobody knew when it was first ordered built, but today, the winning design from Eero Saarinen still rises to the occasion.
There's nothing like it. Nothing even remotely. The scale, the symbolism, it fits so perfectly.
The monument gets a lot of Jennifer Clark's attention, both as museum curator at Gateway Arch Park and as a civilian navigating her adopted hometown.
Well, at first, it really helped keep me from getting lost. I was like, okay, arch in the river, keep that on the right, and I'll know where I'm going.
Clark's found you don't have to be peeking through buildings or around corners to spot the curve as a design element all over the region.
It's meant to talk about the people who went west, the gateway, but it's really become a symbol for people in St. Louis, of home, of St. Louis itself.
Hundreds of businesses and organizations answered a call to submit their logos for a new exhibit that demonstrates how other ventures have adopted the arch. The logo for performing arts organization La Voûte shows a capital V spilling into an arched shape against the colors of the St. Louis flag. Artistic director Brandon Fink says the vision of the memorial is reflective of their own goals.
It's built to stand, it's built to last, and we want people to know where we come from. And there is world-class art here in St. Louis, and we aim to share that not only within our own community, but abroad.
The Unseen St. Louis project shares lesser-known stories of the area. Still, its logo features the familiar. The arch, just flipped upside down to make the U in Unseen. Historian Jackie Dana says it's still the best shorthand for the city.
It's part of my logo for a project that I very much love and is very important to me, and the arch is a part of that. So it's almost like the arch is a part of me in a way.
The arch is a simple curve that graphic designer Eric Tokey says calls to mind both a classic Arc de Triomphe and a portal to the future, a conquest of the people.
It's an expression of movement. It's spectacular. I've always said it's the best work of modernist sculpture anywhere in this country. It contains so many ideas expressed so elegantly.
The symbolic potential may be irrefutable, but the arch grounds literally overlay what was once a densely populated black neighborhood. The westward expansion it commemorates meant staking claim to land from beneath the feet of Native peoples. That context is acknowledged throughout the Arch Park's exhibits, including this one, but the arch itself has largely escaped the re-examination and reckoning that so many other public works have faced in recent years. Tolkien theorizes it's because it's a memorial that's never looked back.
This is a city that approached that opportunity to put a memorial to Thomas Jefferson and westward expansion up and chose the most metaphorical, the most elegant, the most oblique answer. Saarinen's great contribution to us was putting a reminder in our front lawn that says, go for the big idea.
He says that's what makes it such a good icon for the city. Jennifer Clark says she simply can't stop spotting the arch since starting work on the exhibit. It's proof that even the national park itself can't wholly claim it anymore.
Definitely fair to say the community has adopted the arch as their own.
For St. Louisans looking to find their way and to establish themselves, hey, look, there's the arch. I'm Abby Larico, St. Louis Public Radio.
There's more to come on Statewide. We'll be back in a moment. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Mentorship is a critical part of life for people in prison, and it helps the incarcerated provide support to one another. The Danville Correctional Center has led Illinois in encouraging these kinds of relationships with formal group classes. The curricula range from conflict resolution to parenting to budgeting for life after prison. As part of a series on prison education, Emily Hayes spoke with three men about how the program is going.
I'm Larry McCaskill. I've been a part of the program since 2018.
Being in these groups where you hear yourself say these things that you don't say out loud, right? These harsh realities, these black and white absolutes that you think make sense, right? And then you hear other people's truths. And more than anything, I started to understand how unhappy I was because my life was, it felt like I had no agency, no power. Like everything was already preordained. If you do this, I have to say this. I have to do this, right? And I had no choice. And so for me, the beginning experiences were liberating because it was like, wait. I have cornered myself off in life where there are entire regions of my personality I have never tapped into. Anyone who knows me, like, I am like comic book reading, anime watching, Marvel obsessed nerd. And I thought I was this hardcore, fully committed to like this one life. And so when you come to a place like Danville and there's so much movement and you come to the building block and there's so many personalities and there's so many different things to experience, right? So many different perspectives. You start meeting the people who love comic books just as much as you're going to love comic books. The people who play Magic the Gathering and you're like, wait, I actually like this game, right? There's a softness that starts to settle in.
Robert Mueller, everybody calls me Bob. I'm part of the New Life program, which everybody keeps referring to as the reentry program. So we deal with the guys that are just about ready to go home. We also have a life, it's called a Life 2.0 simulation. It's a game, but it's really a financial responsibility simulation. So guys get a job on the wing. They might be the shoe store, they might be the gas station, they might be the grocery store, they might be the car salesman. And they actually sell cards that are the actual products. So shoes, you get a picture of shoes with a price on it. So for that job, you get paid a wage. You start out with a $15 an hour wage, and then that allows you then to pay your bills. So you have to have a place to live, you have to have a good car, you got to get your driver's license. We had one of our coaches went home, and he did contact one of our guys that was still here, one of his friends that was another coach. He said, I didn't really appreciate at the time how much the simulation was helping me. And when I went home and now I have to pay my bills every month, if I didn't have that, he had been gone for 25, 26 years, something like that. And he would not have had the discipline. He goes, I would have forgotten about paying. As an educator, the biggest thing that you have to do is find out whether what you're doing is working. And we don't know right now. I mean, we think we're doing a good job. Guys like our program, seem to like our program, and when they leave, they're appreciative of the work that's been put in. But we don't have any concrete evidence the way we would like to.
Myself, I'm a coach on the reentry wing. I'm Antonio Jones. I have a group, parenting group, where I'll be going through parenting strategies and techniques and self-improvement and self-awareness techniques with a cognitive behavioral therapy approach as well as a trauma-informed approach.
I had hidden resentment toward my father that I didn't realize prior to me actually engaging in his fatherhood course. Like, my father was very abusive and he was addicted to drugs from my infancy on up until my incarceration. And he actually passed away since I've been gone, so that makes it more a much more deeper conflict for me. There were several times when myself, I reached out for help to my educational providers and guidance counselors. I suffered abuse as a child and neglect, and I told literally to them, and my voice wasn't heard. And I believe if children reach out to you for help, you should reach back. And had they done that, it would have probably been a different trajectory for my life. I have a son that I don't know. I've never really met him since he was an infant, so that's something that's very difficult for me to grapple with and to come to terms with and to prepare myself to be able to re-enter society and hopefully reconnect with him, because something that I advocate to every guy in my group specifically is that just because you're incarcerated, your role as a father doesn't stop.
That's Larry McCaskill, Robert Mueller, and Antonio Jones. They spoke with Emily Hayes last year. They've been in prison for about 2 decades for murder or sexual assault. First elected in 2016, Susana Mendoza has been Illinois' comptroller for nearly a decade, and now she's stepping aside. 4 Democrats are vying for the seat in the primary election. Isabella Nieto has more.
The comptroller is the state's top fiscal officer, managing state funds, paying bills, and overseeing important state financial accounts. Democratic candidate Holly Kim is the 2-term Lake County treasurer. She says her experience makes her uniquely qualified to be comptroller.
I manage staff and I manage billions of dollars of public funds. And so what that meant is that I have to be very prudent financially and make good decisions.
Kim has been endorsed by Mendoza, but she isn't the only candidate to be endorsed by a state official. Democratic Representative Margaret Croak, who represents parts of the Gold Coast, Old Town, Lincoln Park, and East Lakeview neighborhoods of Chicago, received an endorsement from Governor J.B. Pritzker. Croak, a former Pritzker staffer, says as comptroller, she wants to work on transparency and efficiency.
I think that's really important that taxpayers are able to see the life cycle of their dollars.
She also says she likes to work with constituents when creating legislation, and she aims to improve the lives of Illinoisans through public service. Croak is joined by other state legislators in the race. 7-term Democratic Representative Stephanie Kifowit represents all or parts of Aurora, Naperville, and other southwestern suburbs. She says she has a long history of working with the comptroller's office on budgets and financial legislation.
I bring the experience that I think we need during this turbulent time on the national level with the Trump administration and some of these funding issues and the lawsuits.
She says she wants to prepare the state for any further federal uncertainty. From the other chamber of the General Assembly, Democratic State Senator Corina Villa is also in the running. She's been in the Senate since 2021 after a 2-year stint in the House. Villa says her time as a school social worker during a budget stalemate from 2015 to 2017 under former Republican Governor Bruce Rauner inspired her to run for office and keep an eye on the state's finances.
Because I believe that budgets are moral documents, that we have to put our money where our values are, and that we need to stop thinking that austerity is the only solution.
She says she wants to be a voice for the financial needs of Illinoisans across the state. Kim, Croak, Kifowit, and Villa will appear on the March primary ballot. Downstate lawyer Brian Drew is the sole Republican candidate. I'm Isabella Nieto.
I'm reporter Araceli Gomez Aldana with voting info ahead of Tuesday's primary elections. It's important to know your rights and what security will look like at in-person polling places. Ed Yonka is with the ACLU of Illinois. He says polling places should be safe and free of intimidation, both from governmental actors or others.
Those messages have made it to folks who are prepared to respond, whether that is state officials or whether that's not-for-profit groups or others. People are ready. You know, the voter's job is to go and vote. if those circumstances arise, organizations like ours will be ready to step into the breach and protect voting rights in this state.
And remember your rights as you head into the polls. Voters usually do not need a photo ID in Illinois unless you're registering to vote or updating your address on Election Day. If you're in line when the polls close, you still get a chance to cast your ballot. And you can take notes or printed materials into the voting booth. You are allowed to vote if you have a criminal record, as long as you're still not serving your sentence. And did you know that you can request up to 2 hours off of work to go vote? It's your right to ask for the time off if your job prevents you from getting there while the polls are open. And if you're challenged by an election judge, you are entitled to a provisional ballot. Make sure the poll worker clearly explains any steps you need to take so your vote counts. I'm Araceli Gomez Aldana.
Well, the primary elections are coming up next week, and one office on the ballot you might not know much about is the regional superintendent of schools. It's the state's only partisan elected education role. And Peter Medlin, the education reporter at WNIJ, spoke with Mark Klaesner to explain. He's the president of the Illinois Association of Regional Superintendents of Schools.
What are the main responsibilities of a regional superintendent?
Primarily in statute, we have three responsibilities in our office. One is around professional learning. You think about like Teacher Institute Day. The second one is around safety. So we actually inspect all 4,000 schools in the state of Illinois to make sure that they are physically safe. But then we also do compliance around procedures and policies. And the third strand is supporting students. And for many, many years, that was pretty much the truancy officer role.
Is this a role that exists in every state? Is it something that some states have, some don't?
Each of the 50 states has some version of our offices. Because our state has so many school districts, we have
864,
more.
Yeah.
Right. We have so many more offices than many others.
How many regions are there now?
38.
In some states, the state superintendent is an elected position. It's not in Illinois. It's an appointed role. And local superintendents aren't elected, but voters do get to pick regional superintendents. Do you know why that is?
There are only three states in the country where regional superintendents are elected: Arizona, California, and Illinois. And the history is that our offices, our county offices of education, were constituted in 1865 at the same time county structures were designed. And as you know, sheriffs, coroners, all of those are elected positions. And interestingly, we are actually partisan elected officials. Our school boards across the state of Illinois are nonpartisan. They don't run on a particular party ticket, but the regional supes are elected, and that goes back to the way Illinois set up its structure years and years and years ago.
Are these elections often competitive? I know I was just looking in most counties around our area in northern Illinois, and I would see pretty much only one person on the ballot, either a Republican or a Democrat, depending on the county. But are there some cases where these do get to be competitive elections?
They are not frequently contested. One thing that's strange about our offices is all 38 offices are up for election every 4 years.
Oh, so they all go up at the same time?
Exactly, all 38. And so we're in the thick of that time now. I've been doing this work for about 14 years now. And in a given cycle, there would be 4 or 5 contested across the state out of 38.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about is just for people who are going to the polls soon, and again, seeing this on their ballot, and maybe they feel like they don't know much about it. They want to do maybe a little bit of research before they actually get in the booth and have to make a decision, right? Like, how can voters evaluate whether their current regional superintendent is doing a good job? So like, for people who want to do some research before they vote, like, what are the main issues they should look at? Where can they find more information?
So in general, if you want to look across the state, our website is IARSS.org, Illinois Association of Regional Superintendents of Schools. My advice would be that they Google their own county and regional superintendent. The local office will have a list of all the kinds of things that they're doing. Because we are compliance-based, there are things that we can help with in terms of complaints, hearings, you know, things that we can help community members as well as supporting school districts. So if you quickly were to Google your own county and regional superintendent, it'll give you a link to their page, and you can learn specifically what's happening right in your backyard.
Mark Klaesner with the Illinois Association of Regional Superintendents of Schools. We spoke with Peter Medlin. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being with us. We'll be back again next time with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Listen to us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations. We'll be right back.